Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere. This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. The Sultan of SWAT, the Colossus of Cloud, the King of Crash, the Great Bambino. Of course, I'm talking about Babe Ruth, who died over 70 years ago, but his legend still lives on in big league stadiums and little league fields across America. While we know a lot about Ruth's baseball career, little was known about his early life and how it shaped him to become America's first superstar athlete and celebrity. My guest today sought to remedy that in her recently published biography, The Big Fella, Babe Ruth and the World He Created. Her name is Jane Levy. She's a former sports journalist and the author of two other biographies of baseball greats. We begin our conversation discussing Ruth's sad and difficult childhood in a Baltimore boarding school and how he learned to play baseball from the Zavarian brothers who ran it. We then shift to how Ruth's hunger for affirmation helped him become the country's first real celebrity, and how his baseball career coincided with the burgeoning fields of public relations and technology, ushering in a new era of sports writing, endorsements, and entertainment. We end our conversation discussing Ruth's legacy in the world and business of professional sports. After the show's over, check out our show notes at aom.is/Ruth. Jane joins you now via clearcast.io. Jane Levy, welcome to the show.
I'm so glad to be doing this.
So you got a new biography out about Babe Ruth. It's called The Big Fella, Babe Ruth and the World He Created. So there's a couple of biographies about the Babe out, you know, for the 70 years since he died. Even while he was alive, people were writing biographies about him. Why did you think the time was right for another biography about Babe Ruth?
Truthfully, I didn't think the time was right for another biography of him. It was the last thing I wanted to do, in part because there have been so many biographies of him, as you mentioned, starting back when he was still alive. I think the first one was ghostwritten in 1928, and that was an autobiography, obviously. But the guys who came before me, most notably Bob Cremer, who wrote Babe in 1974, and there was a whole constellation of books published then because it was just as Henry Aaron was approaching Ruth's career home run record, 714. They all did in some way a really, really good job. But when I sat down and read all of those books, which I did before actually signing a contract and agreeing to do this, what was most notable was the omission of his entire childhood. Now, sports biographies have always been a kind of subgenre. You wouldn't be able to write a biography of Winston Churchill or Franklin Delano Roosevelt and leave out the first 20 years of his life. But in sports, you could, because most sports biographies were what Mickey Mantle used to call all that Jack Armstrong shit. They were hagiography, and they were often written for children, and they were just biographies of sports careers, not of sports lives. And so the guys who came before me did an estimable job in reconstructing his career, in reconstructing day by day on the field, his exploits in every which way. But they couldn't really get at the whole person. And so once I established for myself that there was a hole that I might be able to fill, then I had to persuade myself that there was a way to fill it. And so I started the way most biographers do, by making a list of anybody alive that I could still talk to. And of course, that was another inhibition. Everybody that Babe Ruth basically knew or was close to is presently dead. But at the time that I started this, which was back in 2011 or 2012, his daughter, Julia Ruth Stevens, was still alive. She was a perky 95 or 96 years old. I'm not sure which. And I went to visit her at her family home in New Hampshire. And apropos of nothing that I can claim to have instigated in any smart way, she suddenly leaned over to me and said in a very kind of pert way, "You do know that George Herman Ruth Sr., in other words, Babe's father, and Katie, his mother, were separated." And she actually sort of whispered it in a confidential way. And I looked at her, my jaw dropped. I looked at her, I said, "No, I did not know that. And frankly, nobody knew that." So I called up then one of his granddaughters, a daughter of his other daughter, now deceased, Dorothy. And I said, "Julia said the most amazing thing." And she said, "Oh, hell, they weren't separated. They were divorced." And, you know, there's the moment for a reporter. You just go, aha, now I see it. Because to come from a family that was as chaotic, violent, and as destructive as his was, that ended up in a divorce, which was publicized at the time in the hometown papers. George Herman Ruth Sr.'s divorce from Katie made news in the Baltimore Sun and the Baltimore American in May 1906. But when Babe Ruth was alive and playing and being asked questions, which I assume he was asked to some extent, about where he came from, about his parents, that wasn't something you talked about. There were no 20-minute segments on 60 Minutes in which to air one's, you know, personal history and gather sympathy for having triumphed over them. So Babe Ruth kept it quiet. He never, ever, ever talked about where his family was, where they came from. He never answered any questions. And so I hoped going into it that if I could fill in that hole and find the boy that his family called Little George, I might be able to explain the relationship between Little George and the big fella that he became.
So that's the big idea in your book. To understand Babe Ruth, you have to understand his childhood. And it's interesting because there's sort of... Because Babe didn't talk.
I think Freud would say the same
right.
By the way. Yeah.
But I mean, like, yeah, Babe, since he never talked about his childhood, there's sort of these myths that he was an orphan and that he didn't have any parents or his parents died. But as you said, that wasn't the case.
No, in fact, what happened was this. The divorce was ugly. And the causes that were stated in the Baltimore Sun for granting this divorce to George Sr. were adultery and drunkenness. So all I had to do, and this doesn't make me a great reporter, it makes me a lucky reporter, was go into the archives of the Maryland State Archives and type in the words George Herman Ruth V. I contributed the V, Katie Ruth, and up popped a 150-page dossier with all the depositions, police reports, et cetera, revealing just, again, how chaotic, violent, and destructive this family and this disintegration of the family was. George Sr., according to his testimony in the divorce, found his wife on the, quote, dinging room floor with one of his bartenders, George Ruth, having managed or owned several bars around Baltimore in Babe's time. And so who was going to talk about that? You didn't talk about that in 1906 or 1920 or 1927 when Babe Ruth hit 60 home runs and is king of the world. You just didn't say it out loud. Today, you know, everybody gets divorced, right? So big schmear. But back then, no. So the reason that he was sent away was speculated upon forever, since he wouldn't ever say what really had happened. So people came to two conclusions. One was that he was an incorrigible, which was a legal term used back then to describe boys who got in trouble with the law and who were sent by the courts to a quasi-public institution, in this case, St. Mary's Industrial School for Boys, which was a school that sat outside the main downtown of Baltimore on the cusp of Baltimore City, and where they accepted incorrigibles, as they were legally defined. They also accepted wayward boys, abandoned boys, orphaned boys and boarding students. So I'll often go around to groups when I talk and say, which do you think Babe Ruth was? And everybody will raise their hand and say, oh, he was a bad kid. He was, you know, he was stealing stuff on the waterfront. He was getting in trouble with the law. And other people raise their hand and say, oh, no, he was an orphan. St. Mary's was an orphanage. Well, yes, they took some orphans, but they were not primarily an orphanage. In fact, Babe Ruth was a boarding student, and his father paid for him to live there and never bothered to go visit him once, by the way, in the entire time that he was living there. The boys thought of themselves as inmates. There really was no place else for them to go. There were not, you know, big fences and guys with guns on the roof, as has often been written. But it was not a warm and cuddly atmosphere. And it was to Babe Ruth's advantage to allow people to conclude two completely opposite and erroneous things about him rather than to tell the truth. A reporter from St. Louis said to him in 1929, well, you're an orphan, right, Babe? And he got really angry and he would pound his fist on the table and say, no, I had parents. But he would never go further than that. Well, you were a really bad kid. No, I wasn't a bad kid. Ask the brothers at St. Mary's. There's a Varian brothers, a teaching order that ran the school, but he never filled in the gaps. And so the myths proliferated and became set in amber, and he couldn't escape them after a while. And he didn't really have much interest in doing so.
So what I thought was interesting about this book is it's not a life to death narrative of Ruth's life. Rather, what you do is you take this barnstorming tour that Ruth and Lou Gehrig did after the 1927 baseball season and use that as a jumping off point to explore different parts of Ruth's life. So first, talk about what this barnstorming, because I didn't know that this happened back in the 20s in professional baseball, what that is. And then why'd you use this as the narrative framework for Ruth's life?
Sure. Barnstorming, which is, of course, an aviator's term. It's what, you know, used to call it when aviators in the early years, like Lindbergh, would fly in and out of cities in small planes delivering mail and things. Barnstorming was a long time tradition for ballplayers who, of course, didn't make a lot of money back in the day to make extra money during the off season. And they would organize teams, sometimes around a couple of stars. There was a, for a while, there was a Babe Ruth all-star team, but even Bob Feller and, you know, had a traveling barnstorming team in the 40s. So it was a tradition. And what I wanted to do was get Babe Ruth out of the city. I wanted to be able to give a portrait of him at the apex of his career. So this tour in 1927, organized by his agent, Christy Walsh, was almost a victory lap of the country. It starts just 10 days after he's hit his 60th home run. And they go caravanning from town to town to town and playing essentially not quite pickup games, but they play baseball games against sometimes a minor league team or a semi-pro team. Remember, there was a lot of baseball talent in America and people played in organized leagues, and they would collect money wherever they went. And Christy Walsh, who was very, very savvy, made sure to get the money up front. And when they didn't get the money up front, one time in Asbury Park, Babe and Gehrig sat in their underwear in a hotel suite at a hotel waiting for somebody to come up with the cash. So what this did was allow me to show Babe Ruth at the absolute apex of his fame and to show what it was like to be him and to be around him. And that you didn't really get in the New York papers, because New York writers basically didn't write what he said. They often made it up or they just didn't quote him at all. But the local reporters, for whom this was a once in a lifetime event, that Babe Ruth was coming to their town, wrote down every detail of what they said, what they did, who they got an award from, what the woman was wearing, who gave them the award, you name it. So there was a gold mine of information that could give you a flavor of what it was like to be him. Because to be Babe Ruth in 1927 was to be the first really great modern celebrity. And I would say, and I think I did say, he was the most famous man in America who wanted that fame. Lindbergh, obviously, who had crossed the Atlantic in the Spirit of St. Louis that year, he was as famous, certainly, but he didn't really want to be. He liked being up in the sky, away from the pressing the flesh. Babe Ruth, the little boy who was sent away to an institution at age 7, where he learned how to be public. He lived in dorms with boys who slept head to toe in rose beds that were separated by just a bentwood chair. He was never alone as a kid. So what he learned as a little boy, and this was the revelation for me, what he learned was how to be public. And he learned to be comfortable surrounded by a mass of male energy. And so with the pictures you see of him, and one especially taken in Syracuse in 1925 during a Yankee off day, when they played an exhibition game there, where 5,000 boys try to cram themselves into a single frame with the Babe, and they're draped over him like a cheap fur boa, and they can't get enough of him. And more to the point, he can't get enough of them.
Babe wanted to be famous, but did he start playing baseball so he could be famous and be a celebrity? Or did he have a talent for baseball that people recognized and he became a celebrity? And then he's like, that feels good, and just did more to foster that.
Baseball was an organizing principle at St. Mary's. They had a chronically overcrowded place. And the way they could channel all that energy was to organize leagues and teams. And so whenever they weren't in the classroom, and they weren't in the classroom all day, the way, you know, kids are today or would have been in regular schools, they sent them outside morning, noon, and night, you know, spring, summer, fall, and winter to play baseball. So it was almost like a farm system for growing baseball talent. And he stood out from the beginning, partly because he was bigger than everybody else. Later in his time at St. Mary's, people would assume that he was a staff member because he was so much bigger than everybody else. There was a system of athletics there and people who really knew the game and how to teach it. The one who is most often credited with having turned him into the ball player he is was a guy named Brother Matthias, who was a kind of a mythical giant, depending on who you believed. He was 6'4 or 6'6 and 225 or 250. And he certainly was there, and he certainly had a lot to do with the Babe, but he wasn't the only one. There were a couple of other brothers who knew their stuff out on the ball field. And he was given an opportunity to shine. And this was a kid who needed to shine and who wanted the attention that clearly he wasn't getting in any other way. At St. Mary's, you got visitors on a Sunday once a month. And, you know, one of the few remaining accounts of his life there, a friend of his wrote that another Sunday came and went and Babe had no visitors. And he said, I guess I'm just too big and ugly to visit. So this was a kid who needed and wanted attention. And what better way to get it than by throwing a ball further and harder than anybody else could? Because, of course, first he was a pitcher, as we all know. So he didn't set out to be famous. That kind of fame didn't exist certainly in sports. Remember, when he was a rookie with the Boston Red Sox in 1914, having been mustered out of St. Mary's by Jack Dunn, owner of the minor league Baltimore Orioles, and then sold just 6 months later to the Red Sox, fame was a local thing. It was the circumference of the distribution of a local newspaper, where as far as a newspaper boy could hurl a, you know, the morning paper, there was no radio. So what you learned about famous acts and things after the fact. So one of the fascinating things about Babe's life is to look at it in terms of how much the country changed. And felicitously for him, it changed so profoundly in a kind of revolutionary moment in the 20s, just as he was assuming the, you know, full height of his powers.
And there were people in Babe's life that were facilitating this change in modern America. And you mentioned one of them, Christy Walsh, who was sort of his manager. Like, this is the thing, like you said, like Babe Ruth created a whole new world that didn't exist before him. And something that didn't exist really at that time before him were a sports manager or an agent or a PR person. Christy Walsh was kind of like all this and wrapped up into one. So tell us about him and his influence in Ruth's life, as well as shaping what sports is today or what celebrity is today.
So Christy Walsh was a failed sports writer, failed sports cartoonist, failed account manager at an advertising place when in February 1921, he decided that the only way he was going to get himself out of his latest jam, being fired by an advertising company in New York, was to hook up with Babe Ruth. Now, of course, everybody wanted to hook up with Babe Ruth. He had been sold to the Yankees. December 26, 1919, he had played his first season in New York to great, you know, acclaim and an unprecedented show of power. And now everybody wants a part of him. And who's Christy Walsh? How's he gonna get, you know, in front of Babe Ruth to position himself to represent him? Well, finally, Christy's nephew told me this. In desperation, he found out where Babe was staying in a hotel, climbed up the outside fire escape that, you have those clinging to buildings in New York City, opened the window to his room a crack, saw Babe Ruth in bed with a blonde, climbed through the window, slapped him on the butt and said, "I want to represent you." And what he wanted to represent him in was selling ghostwritten stories under his name. Now, again, there is no radio. How are people going to hear what their heroes have to say about the games and the World Series and their triumphs and their, you know, despair? They're going to read columns that are published and syndicated and published across the country in these little 600, 800 word articles that are purportedly written by their heroes. Well, in fact, their heroes never wrote them. Babe Ruth never wrote his columns. Christy Walsh would find a ghostwriter, initially himself and then later important New York sports writers, to put words in Babe Ruth's mouth. But he did it successfully, and he created a system that was so successful that ultimately he had Ruth and Gehrig and John McGraw, the manager of the New York Giants, and Miller Huggins, the manager of the Yankees, and on and on. He cornered the market in that kind of talent. And people kind of knew that this was not really necessarily what they exactly said, but it still gave the illusion that the athletes were talking directly to them. And Walsh was so successful at this. And Babe, you know, comes to New York just as the field of marketing and public relations is taking shape, and Madison Avenue is being born under the tutelage of Edward Bernays and Ivy Lee. And people are learning how to sell things, commodities, personalities, politicians, to people who didn't necessarily know they wanted them or liked them or needed them. And Walsh applied all the techniques that those guys were using to sell soap or whatever else there was to selling Babe Ruth. And so he got him endorsements that, you know, were that were unprecedented in their value. Other people had endorsed chewing gum or tobacco or whatever, but this was systematic and so much bigger. So that in 1927, for example, Babe Ruth becomes the first athlete to earn more from his accumulated activities off the field than he earned from the Yankees for hitting 60 home runs and playing the outfield. So he earned 73 from the Yankees and almost $1,000 more for that than that for vaudeville, for his ghostwritten columns, for endorsements. This was a revolutionary development. And what Christy Walsh understood, I think before anybody else, was that athletes could be merchandised and marketed as entertainers. He understood that athletes should be paid not just for the home runs they hit out of ballparks, as in Ruth's case, but for the people they brought into ballparks. So it's a whole revolutionary and different way of looking at the worth of an athlete. And that was a radical departure Walsh is really the original Jerry Maguire, frankly.
Texas Pete is the sauce that allows you to sauce like you mean it. Each Texas Pete sauce is packed with a bold, balanced flavor. The signature tanginess is what makes it a legendary hot sauce that can be used on just about anything. You're definitely going to want to try every flavor. The original hot sauce has a famous secret blend of fermented peppers. Their hotter hot sauce is 3 times hotter than the original, and it's not for the faint of heart. They also got a flavor called Sabor by Texas Pete, adds authentic Mexican flavor, and they also have a dust dry seasoning that matches the flavor of the original hot sauce in a flavorful dry rub. But the flavor that I've been enjoying lately is the chopped sriracha sauce. It's got chili, garlic, and some tropical tangy notes. It's really good. I love putting on my eggs. Texas Pete, sauce like you mean it. Visit TexasPete.com and use the store locator to find Texas Pete products as well as purchase sauces and get recipe inspiration. And you can use promo code PODCAST24 for 20% off at TexasPete.com. That's PODCAST24 for 20% off at TexasPete.com. Check out the Sriracha Cha Sauce. Do you know what moms love? Moms love pictures of their kids and of their grandkids. At least my mom does. She loves pictures of my kids. And if your mom is like my mom and loves pictures of her grandkids, I got the perfect gift for her for Mother's Day. It's called the Aura Frame. The Aura Frame is a beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frame that allows you to share and display unlimited photos with your mom or anybody who likes pictures. This is a really cool product. The frame itself looks fantastic. The display is amazing. It's easy to set up. You just connect it to the Aura app, and then you can start uploading photos to this frame from the comfort of your own home. So I'm here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I can upload a photo via the Aura app, and my mom in Oklahoma City will start seeing it displayed in her Aura frame. And besides photos, you can also upload videos as well. It's a really cool, cool product for Mother's Day, and Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com and use code MANLINESS to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. That's A-U-R-A, frames.com. Use code MANLINESS at checkout to get $30 off plus free shipping for their best-selling frame. Terms and conditions apply. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. If you're like me, you've probably signed up for subscription services, but then you forgot about them. I'm talking about newsletters, streaming services, things like that. Well, with the personal finance app Rocket Money, it can help you find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions. It can also monitor your spending and help you lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. I had a chance to use Rocket Money, connected it to my checking account, and it found a bunch of subscription services that I forgot about. I was able to cancel them, and I was able to save a lot of money because the stuff adds up. Besides canceling your unwanted subscriptions, Rocket Money will even try to negotiate lower bills for you, up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/manliness. That's rocketmoney.com/manliness, rocketmoney.com/manliness. So Walsh not only played a part in this, crafting this image of Ruth that helped him become a living legend, but you also talk about how sports writers, other sports writers contributed to this. This is a fascinating history of America as well, because before Ruth, some newspapers had sports sections. Very few had, you know, dedicated sports departments, but now that's something we take for granted. Of course, the newspaper is going to have a sports section. Of course, it's going to have a sports department. How did sports writing, or how did Babe Ruth, or what was the relationship between Babe Ruth and sports writers that, I mean, did they feed off of each other?
So one sports writer, and I frankly couldn't find out who it was. If somebody knows, please let me know, said of Ruth, he was a Sunday buffet every day of the week. He was the greatest story to write about that sports writers had ever had. And unlike other sports, you know, and basketball certainly wasn't a big deal then. The NFL was just being formed then. Baseball was daily. And 24/7 coverage was really invented to keep track of Babe Ruth. And it was invented by the New York Daily News, which was America's first tabloid, went to print in June 1919, 6 months before Harry Frazee, owner of the Red Sox, stupidly and legendarily sold Babe Ruth to the Yankees. And suddenly people are recognizing the importance of image over word. Well, you know, think of the images of Babe Ruth and that rubbery, mobile face of his and that swing, you know, that uppercut swing is with his chin lifted as he looks towards the right field stands as he's following the flight of yet another incredible, you know, home run. So Babe Ruth demanded coverage. With Marshall Hunt, the guy who covered him for the Daily News for so many years and who was the pioneer of the 24/7 coverage, basically said, you know, he took up 2/3 of every afternoon newspaper in New York. And this is, you know, this is known. The 20s are known as the golden age of sports, but what they really were was the golden age of sports writing and of newspapering. There were, I think, 15 daily newspapers in New York City in the 20s. And this is how people got the information. Radio was not yet in those early days, you know, available to give you the scores and the updates. People gathered at street corners to wait for the afternoon paper to come in. Because, of course, remember, people were playing afternoon games. But the revolution that was going on in mass media, including tabloid news, was as earth-shaking and as profound as the advent of personal computing in our lifetime. So imagine suddenly there's the first major league game is covered on radio from Pittsburgh in the August 1921. Now it's still so revolutionary and new that fall when the Yankees play a pivotal series against the Cleveland Indians that's going to decide the pennant, people on the east side of New York employ a guy with a pigeon to go to the polo grounds. Yankee Stadium didn't exist yet, and have the pigeon fly back and forth from the ballpark to their neighborhood with updates every inning. That's how paltry information was. And of course, by 1927, things had changed so radically that the World Series was covered coast to coast, not by one, but by two brand new radio networks, NBC and CBS. So Babe Ruth came along just at the right moment to be publicized and aggrandized. And the one thing they didn't do was write about his private life. There was, an on the field and an off the field. And nobody wanted to tread on Babe Ruth's indiscretions. Everybody knew about them. Nobody wrote about them. Walsh was very good about keeping stuff out of the press. But even that, you know, even that precedent was set in 1925 when suddenly he was suspended on August 30th, 1925 for he'd been late. He'd been out drinking. What people didn't know was that his first marriage had fallen apart. And Miller Huggins finally is fed up and fines and suspends him. And it becomes this huge story, front page news everywhere. And the owner and founder of the Daily News, Joseph Patterson, decides enough is enough. We're done protecting him. We're going to treat Babe Ruth as news, not as a sports icon. And they plaster the picture of his mistress, who would become his second wife, on the front page of the Daily News, where she would remain for 3 days. And the story was a huge, huge thing all across the country. So, as I said, it's a revolutionary moment for both, and they took advantage of it in terms of promoting him and having him be paid for it. And they also suffered in the ways that modern athletes do, being penalized by how much could now be known about them.
I like the distinction you make between the two types of journalists. There's the journalists who, you know, went out of their way to protect Ruth's image. They didn't say anything about his negative stuff. You called them the gee whiz journalists. And then the journalists who knew that, you know, he had some shady stuff going on in his private life, weren't upset at him, and they finally, you know, disclosed it. Those are the odd nuts.
Yes.
Journalists.
I can't take credit for those terms. They've been around in sports writing forever. I think it might have been Stanley Woodward, the famous sports editor of the New York Tribune, Herald Tribune, who coined them. But yeah, I mean, people were writing parables. Grantland Rice was the most famous of them, nationally syndicated columnist who wrote the whole thing about the four horsemen of the apocalypse. They literally would write little poems at the beginning of sports columns, and they thought of themselves as writing great dramas. They didn't go down to locker rooms and ask questions. They didn't peer into locker rooms and see into lockers and see, you know, a thing of steroid cream in the top shelf and report on it. They thought of themselves as writing about, you know, great dramas of good and evil and triumph and failure. And that predominated, and I would say it predominated probably all the way through to 1957 when the New York Yankees and Mickey Mantle et al. Were involved in a fracas, it was called, at the Copacabana. So sports writing's always had the rap on it that it was, you know, you're writing in the playpen. But it has evolved and it has grown up. And, you know, some readers assail it because they want to read the sports page for enjoyment, not for, you know, tales of steroids and money and, you know, wife beating and blah, 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 blah. But it all started to come apart, you know, in 1925 with Joe Patterson and Babe Ruth.
Yeah, and so those gee whiz journalists, like they helped create the legend. They were a part of creating the legend of Ruth that's still with us today.
Well, for example, you know, the 1927 barnstorming tour, Walsh invited a guy along, a reporter and magazine writer for Collier's, who went along with them on parts of their train tour of the country. And, you know, he fed him all this stuff about Babe as the wise elder, teaching Lou Gehrig the ropes of how to be a public person, and quoted him, you know, at length and seriously, giving Gehrig lessons in how to behave, which is, in retrospect, of course, laughable. If there were any indiscretions committed on that tour, neither John B. Kennedy nor Christy Walsh were talking about him. But Gehrig's quoted as saying, "Oh yeah, it was a real education traveling around with the Babe. We sure would have been arrested a number of times if it hadn't been for him." Well, probably if it hadn't been for him, they wouldn't have had committed whatever offense it was that might have gotten them arrested. But it was to Ruth's benefit and to Christy Walsh's benefit to promote Ruth. As this is just 2 years after the horror show of the revelation of, you know, the discord in his marriage. Nobody actually wrote what they may have known, which was that they were already had already signed a separation agreement. But it was 2 years later, he's trying to promote Ruth as this wise elder, this guy who's mature, a mature man of the world, who's, you know, figured out how to behave. And in some ways, it was actually true, because having hit the bottom in 25 with this, you know, scandal about his marriage, and earlier that season, the stomach ache heard around the world when he passed out and almost died en route back to New York after spring training. You know, Christy Walsh really did whip him into shape. He made it very clear to him that, you know, he had to cut back on the gambling. He had to cut back on the eating. He had to cut back on, you know, he had to learn to keep his indiscretions private, as Paul Gallico wrote about Ruth later. And he learned that lesson well. He wasn't completely reformed ever. Charmingly, never completely reformed, but he was more careful about it.
Yeah, so his private life, he lived life in excess. He ate a lot, he drank a lot, womanized, he did gambled. I mean, he did everything to the full hilt.
You know, it's funny, people talk about how many hot dogs he ate, because of course that was the legend, was that he ate so many hot dogs, that's how he got that stomach ache heard around the world, which of course was preposterous. But at St. Mary's, those boys were fed meat once a week. And guess what that meat was? Hot dogs. Is it any surprise that Babe Ruth would spend his adult life trying to fill up the holes and the emptiness of his childhood, literally with hot dogs, but then also with an excess of everything, having had so little, you know, women, beer, you know, gambling. And he got himself into real debt, so that by 25 when he signed this separation agreement from his first wife, which called for him to pay her $100,000 over four installments over 4 years. He didn't have the money. And the way Christy Walsh maneuvered to get complete control over him and thus, you know, saved his butt financially and put his house in order was by saying, you know, yeah, he would lend him the money that he needed to pay his taxes, but Babe Ruth had to give him permission to be in charge of all his money from then on. And Ruth signs this letter in 1926, which I found in a collection of Christy Walsh archives. And at that point, Christy Walsh is no longer just the syndicator of his ghostwritten columns. He becomes his money manager and his conscience and his guide. And, you know, where Ruth would have been without him is hard to describe.
So you mentioned, you know, his first marriage ends because of his indiscretions. But like, what was he like as a family man? I mean, besides the indiscretions, like, he came from a broken home. Did he intentionally think, I'm going to be a better dad to my kids than my dad was to me? Or did he kind of end up just repeating the patterns he saw that his dad set down?
One of the myths, again, about Babe Ruth is that as soon as he got out of St. Mary's, he ran amok, you know, filling up all those holes in his resume with, you know, spending too much money, eating too much, drinking too much. That's not true. What he did when he got out of St. Mary's was try to create for himself stability and the family he never had. So he married Helen Woodford, a waitress that he had met in Boston at a coffee shop in October of that year. That's a hell of a year, 1914, for Babe Ruth. He gets out of St. Mary's, where he's lived basically in captivity since he was seven. He signs with the Orioles. He makes his major league debut with the Red Sox. He's sent down to the minor leagues and helps the Providence Grays win a championship. And then he gets married. That's not the act of a wild man. That's the act of a guy who's trying to comport with societal norms. He's trying to do the right thing, and that it didn't work. That a marriage between a 19-year-old and a 16-year-old who knew nothing of the world and he knew nothing of what the world was about to offer him, that it wouldn't survive is hardly surprising. He was not a particularly great father, particularly to his first daughter, Dorothy, who died never knowing for sure who her birth parents were. He wouldn't know how to be that kind of parent is, again, not surprising to me. He tried, however. He really did try. I think he was a decent guy trying to do the best that he could.
It seems like with the daughter of his second wife, Claire, whom he adopted, they had a better relationship. And that was the one you talked to, Julia, right?
Sure. Yes. Julia, who died at age 102 last winter, was absolutely devoted to him and saw him and the world through rose-colored glasses. But who blames her? Here's a guy, you know, her birth father had disappeared from her life. I don't even know if she knew what I found out, which was that Claire had divorced him. Claire grew up in Georgia and really was a Southern kind of gal. She had divorced him because he had beaten her. So along comes Babe Ruth, and he gives her his name, and he gives her a life she could never otherwise have had. That her devotion to him is completely understandable.
So, I mean, Babe Ruth became a living legend, like while he was alive, like I can say probably one of the first, you know, sports living legends. But then the really sad part, I started feeling really sad, was when he found out he had cancer, basically, and he started just withering away. How did Ruth handle that? Like, and I mean, because that's a big drop. You're going from like the prime of your life when you hit 60 home runs, and then just a few years later, you realize you're on the, you know, you might be dying here soon. How did Ruth handle that?
Well, I think he handled it gracefully, extremely gracefully. But, you know, the tragedy, if that's the right word, of his life after baseball began after he quit in 1935, midway through a very, very ill-conceived arrangement with the Boston Braves. The Yankees had been done with him at the end of 34, and he wasn't ready to quit. He wanted to manage. He accepted a contract from Emil Fuchs to return to Boston, allegedly to bring the Boston Braves back to success. In fact, he was just really there to, you know, bring in people because they didn't have a prayer of succeeding. And it was clear by the end of May 35 that there was nothing left for him to do on the field. Couldn't run, couldn't, you know, catch a ball in the last game he played. Rhett rolled past him in the outfield and humiliated him. But from then on, baseball had no use for him. Absolutely none. There was no job. He sat by the phone, Claire said, and waiting for it to ring, and it never did, and would cry. Because he had made baseball into the institution and the crowds and all those boys who would pile out of rickety ballparks to surround him. He'd made them the family he didn't have as a boy. And suddenly it was gone. And the repudiation by an abandonment by this second family was a recapitulation of the abandonment of him as a young child. And I think that was excruciating for him. He had one very brief fling as a coach for the Dodgers. Again, he thought maybe they would hire him as a manager. This is at the end of the 30s. No go. And there was really nothing for him to do. He threw himself into raising money for war bonds in the early 40s. And in 1944, the New Yorker sent a reporter for Talk of the Town to ask him how he felt about Japanese soldiers going to their death, charging into line of fire, screaming to hell with Babe Ruth. In Japan, he was still a very big deal. And he said, well, sounds like those are the little itty bitty ones. And which I think is hilarious. But the reporter noticed that his throat sounded very hoarse. And I can't help but wonder whether that wasn't the beginning of the nasal pharyngeal cancer that would take his life. He died on August 16th, 1948, after returning back from yet another road trip. What Babe Ruth knew to do was to travel, was to go out. He went on another barnstorming tour. Ford Motor Company was paying him $500 to go for each city he visited to promote baseball for boys in the Ford leagues. And he went to St. Louis, where he was photographed on the field before a Browns game and posed with Yogi Berra, who later told me he was so nervous he didn't know what to do. Joe DiMaggio gave him a trophy. Billy DeWitt, the son of the owner, who's now the owner of the Cardinals, you know, went down in a uniform and was supposed to be taught how to hit by the Babe. He was the designated child in the alleged clinic that Babe Ruth was way too weak to give. And by the way, Billy DeWitt's uniform was later used by Eddie Goodell, the midget who was, I know you're not supposed to say midget, but back in the day, the midget who was sent up to hit by Bill Veeck, famously, when he inherited the Browns from DeWitt's father. And he went to Minneapolis, where he was interviewed. And it was his last interview. It was a radio interview conducted by an 11-year-old child named Johnny Ross. Johnny was blind. Babe Ruth could barely talk. The cancer that had begun to grow in the nasal passages at the back of his nose, which surgeons had been unable to remove, had grown and encircled his carotid artery. They had to tie it off. He actually was guinea pig for a very early kind of chemotherapy that would prove to be, in later iterations, very successful and still used to some extent today in suppressing certain kinds of cancers. But by August 1948, the handwriting was on the wall. And it was an extraordinary pain. He could eat maybe soft-boiled eggs and drink some beer. And Johnny Ross, this 11-year-old kid, says to him, "So, Babe, how you feeling, Babe?" "Oh, my head's hurting, Johnny. And my throat, it really hurts to talk." "Well, who's going to win the pennant, Babe?" And he answers some such. Undoubtedly, he said the Yankees. "Who's got the best pitching staff, Babe?" And Babe mumbles something. And the kid runs out of things to ask. And Babe Ruth magnanimously and sadly puts his arm around Johnny and says, "It's all right. We're both just about out of words." And then he went home to die. and then the outpouring of affection. Then he was welcomed back at Yankee Stadium, where he lay in state in the rotunda that in the ballpark that had been named for him, the house that Ruth built.
You know, he lived a larger than life character. How did he change the game of baseball, and why are we still talking about him 70 years after he died?
Mike Rizzo, the general manager of the Nationals in Washington, said to me he was the original. He reconfigured the game in his own image. He took it out of the hands of the micromanagers like John McGraw, who were accustomed to moving men around the bases, station to station, you know, telling choke up. They played little ball. You know, you choke up and hit one to left field and we'll move this guy from first to second. And you choke up and hit it to left field and we'll move it, you know, second to third. And Babe Ruth comes along and looks at this, and he was bigger than everybody else. You know, when he gets to Boston in 1914, he's 6'2" and he weighs 185, 190 maybe. And he looks around and he says, well, why should I do that when I can take one swing and put an end to this? So he literally reshaped the game. The power game that is played today is a direct, you know, relative of the power swing that Babe Ruth invented and used to hit 714 career home runs. Having changed the game and ways it was played and the expectations of booms and cracks and thwacks that would ricochet around Yankee Stadium, they then had to make ballparks and equipment that would hold him. I mean, up till then, there were like kind of band boxes. Nobody hit balls over fences. A writer for the New Yorker pointed out that Babe Ruth's invention of the modern power game, the home run, also created a connection between player and spectator that never existed before. Because in the moment that the ball heads into the stands and the spectators grab it, they're connected in a way they had never been before. So he recreated it in every way. He took on the institution when he confronted the first commissioner, Kennesaw Mountain Landis, the former federal judge, over his right to barnstorm in the offseason. There was this crazy rule that if you were on a World Series team, you couldn't barnstorm because somehow that was going to diminish the clout of what was then called big league baseball. It didn't form major league baseball till later as a term of art. And Babe Ruth said to hell with that. Now he got himself in trouble and he got himself fined and suspended, but the rule was changed. And from then on, it was recognized that baseball players had a right to make a living the best way they knew how in the off season. He took on the institution by insisting upon his right to barnstorm against African American players, which other people did, it is true, but he was Babe Ruth. And so by playing with and against African American players, he was giving sanction to them as players. He was also providing a nice payday, which God knows they needed, but he was giving credit to, and he articulated that, you know, the colorful play of the Negro Leaguers would certainly be a good thing in the major leagues. And he took on management by insisting upon his right to have someone represent his interests, Christy Walsh, and to try to rectify the ridiculous imbalance and power between owners and most of the players who were semi-literate or certainly not equipped to go into negotiations to represent themselves. And that imbalance would continue for most players all the way through till when Roger Maris broke the record. He tried to bring his brother with him to negotiate his 1962 contract after hitting 61 home runs in 61. And the Yankees wouldn't let him bring his brother because his brother was an accountant. So, you know, he really struck a blow for players' rights. And he understood that by barnstorming, by taking the game out beyond the Mississippi River, which is, of course, as far as Major League Baseball went in those days, he was doing something good for Major League Baseball. He was creating a market that would take another 30 years for Major League Baseball to begin to exploit.
And besides changing baseball, he changed sports in general. We see the legacy of Ruth with endorsement deals. I mean, you talk about in the book some of the strides he made in publicity law, which didn't exist before him, and cases that he fought. And those guys who've got Nike deals can thank Babe Ruth for that.
And knowing how little history most athletes study these days, I don't think they have any clue how much they owe him.
Well, Jane Levy, thanks so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
My guest today was Jane Levy. She's the author of the book, The Big Fella. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. You can find out more information about her work at her website, janelevy.com. Also, check out our show notes at aom.is/Ruth, where you find links to resources and we can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the AOM podcast. Check out our website at artofmanliness.com where you can find our podcast archives. There's over 500 episodes there, as well as thousands of articles written over the years about physical fitness, productivity, how to be a better husband, better father. And while you're there, make sure to sign up for our weekly or daily newsletter. And if you'd like to enjoy ad-free episodes of the AOM podcast, you can do so on Stitcher Premium. Head over to stitcherpremium.com, sign up, use code manliness to get a free month trial. And once you're signed up, download the Stitcher app on Android or iOS, and you can start enjoying ad-free episodes of the AOM podcast. And if you haven't done so already, I'd appreciate if you take 1 minute to give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps out a lot. And if you've done that already, thank you. Please consider sharing the show with a friend or family member who you think would get something out of it. As always, thank you for the continued support. Until next time, this is Brett McKay, reminding you not only to listen to the AOM podcast, but put what you've heard into action.
Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because... the charcoal mask, great, because why would I put that on my face when I could drop it in my sink? This is what I get for multitasking. Ugh, why is charcoal so sticky?
Hello?
Hey, Janice, I am so sorry. I thought I was on mute. No, we don't need to reschedule. I'll just stay off camera. Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed.